Welcome to the Mount Carmel Christian Church podcast. In our sermon series, Open, we will be looking at how being open to God can help make us more open to others.
Today's speaker is teaching minister Tim Peace.
I've been hit with a little bit of writer's block lately. And writer's block is one of those things that you don't want to get if you're trying to finish writing a really, really, really long book so that you can finish school. And I've hit stretches of writer's block before, and I don't know why, but this particular one has been incredibly agitating and has been kind of long and far-reaching for some reason. And so because of that, I started looking for resources, blog posts from people that have maybe been in my shoes before me to see if anybody had any kind of practical advice so that I could just start to think again and put words on the electronic paper in the Microsoft Word document and get the project done. And so I came across this book via a podcast that I was listening to one morning, and the book is called Deep Work. And the book is written by a gentleman by the name of Cal Newport. And the concept of deep work is this. In order for you to reach whatever pinnacle of success or work that you want to try to accomplish, you need to put away the ways of shallow work that have permeated our culture and learn or relearn to focus all of your attention for long stretches of time, and in a deeply concentrating sort of way. This is what deep work is. And so I continued to read through this book, and it offered all sorts of practical advice for me. It said, you know, one way to keep from getting distracted is to not check your email every 15 minutes. You may anger some people because you haven't responded within 10 seconds of their email to you, but that's okay. Or another thing that he says to do is to stop using social media. Now, at first I was like, I've got this. I've already quit Facebook and Instagram a while back. And then I realized that if I get out my phone and I flip over, I've got that little Tweety bird sitting there. And you know, you get in half hour into whatever project you're working for, and it just feels so good to click that bird so that you can find out just how the Tuesday Bengals practice went for the day. And I don't know why I need to know what someone else's work day was like and whether or not the Bengals were running in full pads or just shorts for the day, but sometimes you need to know. But here's the problem with doing that sort of thing. Apparently, if you're trying to focus and you check social media even just for 5 seconds, you get this sort of mental residue effect, and you can't focus again for like 10 or 20 minutes afterward. I didn't know that, but it makes sense. If you're trying to work for 2 hours straight, concentrating, you can't do that. You also need to embrace boredom, he says. Embracing boredom means that when you're in line at Chipotle, which I'm frequently doing, when you're in line at Chipotle and you're getting bored because the line is long, don't do this. Because that reinforces the fact that you're eventually going to get bored when you're working on something in depth. And guess what you're going to do? You're going to pull out your phone and start doing this stuff. So our culture has grown accustomed to this, and so I had to delete the Twitter app from my phone. I just did. But as I was reading this book, a big idea came out of it, and it's an idea that I had already heard from this gentleman named Mike Rowe. If you've ever heard of Mike Rowe before, he's on a television show called Dirty Jobs, and I think he's been in some truck commercials before. I don't remember which truck it was, though. It was Ford? I'm sorry, Dad. I should have remembered that. Anyway, okay, so he was in Ford commercials. See, everyone knows who Mike Rowe is. This is great. Okay, so Mike Rowe did this video a while back on Prager University's YouTube channel, and he said in this thing, and Cal Newport in the book reinforces this and expands on it, but our culture has bought into this idea, especially younger generations, like me, but also people younger. And it's this. If you want to make something of yourself, if you want to find your calling in life, if you want to figure out what's going to set your heart on fire to do, you have to follow your passion. Ever heard that before? Mike Rowe and then Cal Newport in this book says, follow your passion is absolutely terrible advice. Don't do it. Because see, the thing about follow your passion is a lot like when I'm trying to wait for the great lightning bolt of inspiration to strike in order to motivate me to work on writing that really long book. It very rarely comes. And so this morning, we're going to continue in our series called Open. And we're going to talk about what it means to be open with our stuff this morning. And we're going to end up looking at a couple of passages, one in which I think a new or a different kind of reading, a different aspect of this reading will reinforce this idea of what it truly means to be open. Because the truth is, follow your passion is bad advice. Because passion ought to follow your hard work. And inspiration ought to follow your persistence at work. Now, I had to learn this the hard way in college. I started playing music when I was an eighth grader. My parents got my first guitar at Christmas for me because my dad saw me playing air guitar on a hockey stick in my room when I thought no one was looking. And then the next Christmas, I got a guitar. So that was awesome. The guitar was awesome. The awesome about the air hockey stick was sarcasm. So I've been playing music since I was in eighth grade, and when I got into high school, I wanted to be in a band, so I joined with some of my friends and started playing in a band, and then I thought, you know, I want to be a rock musician for a living. Yeah. And then it gets better. I went to Bible college. Now, I did have that desire. I had some great influencers in my life that led me to want to go to Bible college. And I did, and I went there for those reasons. I do believe I was called there, but I don't think I really knew I was called there at the time. Instead, when I first went into college, I still wanted to be a rock musician. Apparently, ministry in the back of my mind was like my fallback job, which, by the way, is a terrible fallback job idea. But the thing is that my first year of college, my freshman year, I was pretty good at coasting and getting by without having to put in a whole lot of effort and still getting average grades. But my degree major was Bachelor of Arts in Preaching. And Bachelor of Arts meant that I had to take language arts electives. And when you're in Bible college, there are two languages you can take, Greek and Hebrew. I'm a New Testament guy myself, so I picked Greek. And in my sophomore year of college, first semester, I had year one Greek. Now, when I was in high school, I managed to take 4 years of Spanish and passed. And I don't remember a lick of it at all. Because guess what you do in Spanish class in high school? You learn rote memorization, just enough to pass the test, and then the next test, and then the next test, and then you graduate and you don't remember any of the language. So I thought, Greek's a dead language. Who's gonna know? I'll get through this easy. Well, here's the problem. You see, I still wanted to be a rock musician, and so I would find myself practicing with my bandmates until 1 a.m. on a Wednesday night, for instance. And I would have a quiz at 8:30 a.m. the next morning. And so I'd come into the CCU parking lot because I was a commuter about a half hour before the quiz, and I'd try to cram. I'd try to cram material I hadn't even read yet. Now, the first couple quizzes, this worked because the material hadn't built upon itself yet. But eventually, those quiz grades started to go, and by the end of that class, that first semester of Greek, I flunked. I got a 56%. I knew over half the material. Woo! No, I didn't. I didn't know any of it. This is terrible. This is terrible on multiple levels. My parents backed me up to go to Bible college with money. I can remember having to tell my dad that I failed Greek while he was working on his boat outside of, I was hoping that by him working on his boat, it wouldn't go as badly. Anyway, I was embarrassed, but not only that, I was stuck. Because I went into college thinking, I got to get done in 4 years. It's a four-year degree. And now, if I'm going to take Greek, I'm going to have to wait till the beginning of next year to retake the class again. So I went on down and I changed my major to Bachelor of Science. That way I could take the science electives instead of the language arts electives. Oh, this is no joke, and this is what I did. And so, so I changed the major and I did finish in 4 years. But something happened that next semester. I ended up signing up for a class on Paul's letter to the Romans with Dr. Jamie Smith. Now, Jamie Smith at CCU is known for two things. One, he's really good at getting under the skin of students, which as a person that's a people watcher and a lover of sarcasm, I kind of enjoyed watching from a distance. But the second thing, though, that he was really good at doing was he was really good at pushing you to think beyond your capacity. And so for some reason, despite the fact that I wanted to be a rock star and I wanted to coast through school, I started to engage the class. I started to put actual effort into that class. When the professor would call on a volunteer, I would actually raise my hand. And as an introvert, I don't like participating in class discussions, but I did it anyway. And eventually, I ended up doing really, really well in that class. And I ended up turning around my entire college career at that point. And I quit my band because I realized that in working really, really, really hard at this Bible study stuff, I actually cared more about that than I did about being a rock musician. But I didn't just get something like graduating out of that. I did well enough that Dr. Smith recommended me to go to the seminary to pursue my master's degree in New Testament studies. Now, I'll never forget going to thank him for that recommendation because I forgot a detail when I told you about my Greek class. When I went to thank him, I went and I told him, you know, thank you for your effort and the push that you put in me to get where I'm at. I wouldn't be doing what I'm about to do if it weren't for you. And I'm kind of surprised that you did it because I flunked your Greek class in that sophomore year. And I'll never forget the dumbfounded look on his face when I said that. Apparently, F also stands for forgettable. I stood out when I put the hard work in. I was pretty forgettable when I didn't. See, I learned in that semester that passion follows after hard work, not the other way around. And inspiration follows after persistence. And you know, I think Jesus teaches this too. So as we consider what it means to be open with our stuff, I want you to open Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21 with me. Because Jesus teaches a famous passage in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount that's pertinent to our discussion today. And so read with me. Jesus says, "Stop collecting treasures for yourself for your own benefit on earth, where moth and rust eat them and where thieves break in and steal them. Instead, collect treasures for yourselves in heaven, where moth and rust don't eat them and where thieves don't break in and steal them. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Now, a lot of times we hear this passage and we do a couple things with it. The first is we immediately extrapolate the lesson onto our modern sensibilities. And we live in a middle-class kind of culture. We have more than those that were before us had. And compared to the rest of the world, we have more than most. And so when we think about this concept of where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, we assume that Jesus is saying, you know, don't go invest in that retirement account, and don't go put money into that object that you want to buy. Don't save up for that vacation. Instead, give it all to the church. At least that's, you know, how you feel. I don't really like giving sermons, which is why I got to do one today. Anyway, that's what we're used to thinking, at least. That's how I've heard them, even though they've never really been preached in that sort of a mean-spirited way. But it's easy to feel convicted and take it to a level of guilt. No, see, Jesus, when he says this, is teaching people that are a farming community, they're an agrarian culture, and they are poverty-stricken. These people are working for very little. There is no middle class. There's an upper echelon part of society that has it all, and the rest have very little. And so what they do earn, they just wonder if it's going to be enough to get them to the next meal the next day. And guess what they do with it? They take it to their small little village home in which multi-generations are living in that same small home, and they find a piece of clay pottery and they stick their money in there, or they stick it underneath the clay pots for safekeeping purposes. And guess what can happen to that money? If bugs get in there, it can be destroyed. If any sort of worldly, water, earthy kind of damage gets in, it can corrode. And guess what? They didn't have the greatest security systems installed into their little villages, so anyone, while they were out in the field for the day, could walk in and steal their hard-earned money that was just going to get them their bread for the next day. And Jesus is preaching to these people, and he says, don't store up your treasure for your own benefit, for your own safekeeping, looking to keep it safe in these broken, unsafe places. Instead, invest in God's kingdom, because none of the stuff that can break in and destroy and take from you can get there. And then he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, we take that two ways. You've probably heard this one before. If you want to know where someone's heart is, look at their bank account, right? And that's actually true. I'm a both-and kind of person, not an either-or. So keep that in your back pocket. But remember this too. When Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, he is also saying that what you invest your resources in will have your heart. And your heart and your devotion for where you invest will grow. You see, passion follows after hard work. Inspiration follows after persistence. And your heart follows after where your treasure is. I think we know this, and I think the Apostle Paul knew this too. Last week, Dee Dee was telling us about the Corinthian church, and he was telling us about how Paul was calling them to be open. And he does this by telling them, hey, you have so much that you've offered up to God in all your being, but there's this one other thing that you promised to do. You promised to give in support of the mission work that me and my companions were going on. And I want you joyfully to follow through on that commitment. And he looks to this other church, this other poverty-stricken church, and he says, they are your example. Though they don't have much, they followed through on their commitment and their generosity and their openness to God's mission through us. You do the same. And when we turn to chapter 9 in 2 Corinthians, he's on the same subject. And this is what he says in verses 6 through 8. He says, what I mean is this. The one who sows a small number of seeds will also reap a small crop. And the one who sows a generous amount of seeds will also reap a generous crop. Everyone should give whatever they have decided in their heart, They shouldn't give out of hesitation or because of pressure. God, in fact, loves a cheerful giver. God has the power to provide you with more than enough of every kind of grace. That way you will have everything you need always, and in everything to provide more than enough of every kind of good work. Now, there's a couple things here. The first thing that Paul says out of the gate in this passage is that the size of your gift matters. The size of your gift matters. He actually says and uses this analogy that one sows what one reaps. And so if one sows a small number of seeds, they can only expect to reap a small harvest. And if one sows a large portion of seeds, then they can possibly expect to reap an abundance. And so you might expect then that Paul will say, so give me as much money as you can, and I'll send you a prayer shawl afterward. That was a televangelist joke, sorry. That's not what he says, though. Instead, he says, give out of what you've already decided in your heart, because God loves a cheerful giver. See, the size of the gift matters, but the size of the gift is determined by the heart of the giver, not the amount that the giver can give. And then he adds something else on top of this that, in my opinion, is kind of freeing. He says, remember, God's the one that has provided everything to you in the first place. And he's the one that ultimately is in charge of the harvest. You and I, when we invest our stuff, our resources, our whole being in God's work, we just get to play a part and celebrate in the joy of the harvest that God has. And so he's calling the Corinthian church to follow through on the gift they've decided, not above and beyond that, not some huge amount of money. He's not trying to swindle them. He just wants them to play their part in God's work so that they can also take part in the joy that comes from it. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Your heart follows after your treasure. And that's why our bottom line this morning is this: to be open with my stuff is to place my heart in God's mission. To be open with my stuff is to place my heart in God's mission. And I know it's easy to kind of just cower away from this and say, I don't want someone to touch my stuff. But we know this is true. We know that it's true that our heart follows after where we place our treasure. We know that our passion follows after our hard work. We know that our inspiration follows after our persistence in our work. Because if anybody has ever taken up any kind of hobby before, you will know that the more resource you pump into it, the bigger your devotion, the better your skill, and the more your love for that thing grows. I know it to be true. When I was a high schooler, my discipleship group leader was named Rick Anderson. You've seen him on stage this morning. I like to call him The Voice. You should call him that from now on. Rick taught me something that I've heard him say from stage before several times over. He always defines worship as to put worth into something. And in the case of our devotion in life to God, to worship God means to attribute worth to God in everything that we are. And he instilled this in me at a young age. And so as I got involved in the worship music ministry playing music, I had to put this lesson into practice. And I'll tell you how I've done that over the years. I have a confession. I don't like every single Christian worship song that's ever been played in the history of mankind. As a matter of fact, I don't even like half of the ones that I sing sometimes. Sorry. But here's the thing, though. When a song is assigned to me, I go home, I get my guitar out, mainly because my dog has pointed his nose at the guitar case to remind me. I get my guitar out, I listen to the song, I practice the notes, I practice the chords, I learn the melody. I think about how the melody can best be sung so that the congregation can sing along with it. And I put literally hours into practicing so that by the time I get up here on Sunday morning, I can live with the song. But beyond that, I can actually sing it with real worship and real passion because I was already worshiping the week leading up to it. Because passion follows after your hard work. Inspiration follows after persistence. And your heart follows after where you place your treasure. I want to close out with a story. I want to go back to that sophomore year. That sophomore year in college. So I am now a Bachelor of Science, and I've got to take science electives. And so my first science elective that I took was geology with Dr. Bullard. And in Dr. Bullard's class, you were required to go on a geology field trip. It was a weekend-long field trip. I've already established a billion times over that I'm an introvert. I also was a commuter, so I didn't know many of my classmates that well. And I wasn't too keen on spending an entire weekend out in the woods with people I wasn't that familiar with. I can remember Angie, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time. I can remember even calling her and belly aching about having to be at this trip right when we arrived there. I was like, I don't want to be here. I just wish I could be back home hanging out with you. But since I was forced to do this for class credit, I stuck with it. I played along. I took my notes. I did what I was supposed to do along the way, and I actually benefited from it. The first day we saw Cumberland Falls, it was beautiful. We did what all Bible college students should do at some point in time. We sat around a campfire at night and sang worship songs. It was great. It was actually one of my best church worship music experiences I've ever had. And I think it was God buttering me up for the next day, because the next day we went down into Mammoth Cave. And Mammoth Cave, being a big tourist area, is well lit with electrical lighting down in there. So you can walk through once you get to the bottom and see everything, the stalagmites, stalactites. Don't ask me which one's which, I can't remember. But we came close to the end of our trip through Mammoth Cave, and our professor and the tour guide came upon this long slab of earth that almost seemed like a mini amphitheater seating. And they had us all sit down. And then my professor, he took his Bible and he opened it up to John 1:5. And he read, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness doesn't extinguish the light." And then the lights went out. They turned the lights out. Now, if you've ever been, I like a really dark room when I'm sleeping at night, but even if it's as dark as you can get it, there's always a little bit of light from the moon or maybe a street light out there. And so if you're in the dark, you can still somewhat see motion if you move your extremities around in the room. But in this cave, the darkness was so dark, a darkness I had never seen or felt before. They told us to put our hands in front of our face and to move them around, and I couldn't even see the motion of my hand. And then our professor, which I don't know how he didn't burn himself, but he took a lighter and he flicked it on, and a small flame came up from that lighter. And it was as if the light chased the darkness to the corners and the edges of that cave. That lit a fire for me. I came back ready to serve. I knew at that point what I wanted to do, what I needed to do in life, all because I was open to the opportunity to experience something rather than bellyaching about it. And so I came back more engaged with the worship music team than ever. And one Sunday, during that time, I received one of the greatest gifts ever. And it wasn't money, it wasn't material items, It wasn't free food, although that's pretty good. It was just small words. I had finished the worship music set. I had sang a song. I don't remember which one it was that day. But in our old building, we had steps that led out from the stage, and I was at the bottom of the steps standing down here after the service was over on the right side. And I see a short, elderly man come down from the left side, and he's starting to form a smile on his face. And he comes over and he puts his hand on my shoulder. And he says, "Young man, I'm not a big fan of your music style." And being a 20-year-old at the time, I was thinking to myself, what's coming next? But his smile grew, and he said, "But you know what? I love watching you up there doing it, because I love seeing the young people attracted to and taking part in our church." That man's name was Charlie Henderson, and he's one of the founding members of this church. And if there was ever somebody that I could imagine being open with all that they are, it was him. Because I often thought back, and by the way, he would say that to me time and time again. Sometimes I was not sure if he actually remembered saying it the previous time. It was like hearing it for the first time, though, too. I often wondered, I said, what incentive does he have to say that to me? He doesn't like my music style. I grew up listening to rock music. I like it loud. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it. I do. And I definitely did when I was 20. I'm starting to lose a little bit of hearing. But anyway, he had no incentive to do that. He could have kept his mouth shut, or he could have just laid into me for doing something he didn't like. But instead, he gave of the small words that he had to give to a young 20-year-old in order to continue to invest all that he had and all that he was into this place that he helped start. I can think of no better example than what it means to be open with our stuff than that man. So I'm going to ask you today, what can you be open with? What can you be open with? For some of us, it's time. You know, a lot of us are living busy lives, busy schedules. Our time, our energy goes all over the place, and we just don't have another minute to spare. But maybe it might mean cutting something out so that we have a few extra minutes to invest. Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Maybe for some of you, it's your words. Maybe your words need to be held back. Maybe saying something that you're afraid to say needs to be said. And maybe something you're going to say will cause you to lose something for the benefit of the greater good. So say it. Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And for some of us, it's our stuff and our money. And no one likes anybody to get into their wallet. But here's the thing. Paul says God loves a cheerful giver. And a lot of times we'll actually use that verse as an excuse not to give. God loves a cheerful giver, and I'm not happy when the offering bag goes around, so I'm just going to pass it along. Here's the problem with that line of thinking. A, it doesn't say when you're going to become cheerful, does it? And B, your heart follows after where you place your treasure. Give what you can, give just a little bit, just a little bit. And do it again and again and again. And watch your heart and your devotion for God's mission in this world, in this community grow. So this morning, as you leave this place, I want to dare you to be open. I want to dare you to be open with whatever you need to be open with. I want to dare you to be open because your passion follows after your hard work. Inspiration follows after your persistence, and your heart follows after where you place your treasure. Please pray with me. God, we love you and we thank you for being so good to us. We thank you for the many blessings that you've given us. God, I thank you personally for all the times that you've had to knock me upside the head in various ways to get across to me what you want to get across to me. And I thank you so much for the many people in my life that you've put in there to help push me along the way and to guide me and to show me. And God, I pray that you will just help us to be open. A lot of times we think of being open as just something that we just say that we're going to do, but sometimes to be open means to step forward, to take a step at a time, to do the thing we're not ready to do or the thing that we don't want to do. That actually shows our openness. And from there, you can do the rest of the work, and we know that you will. So God, I pray that you will do that for us. And I pray, God, that for some in here, if they haven't made a decision to follow you, that you will open them up to that and that they'll take that step into the waters of baptism and that they will give their life to you and that they can be inspired and encouraged by this church family that has built me up too. We love you, and it's in your Son Jesus' name that we pray.
Thank you for listening. You can interact with us online on our website at www.mtcarmelchurch.org.